Live Creative Now, episode 32.
Welcome to Live Creative Now with Melissa Dinwiddie, a weekly podcast to inspire you to create your art and share your work, because that's how you will change the world.
Hey, Brilliant. This is Live Creative Now, the podcast designed to help you live a full color life. Whether you think of yourself as not artistic, not creative, or you think of yourself as an artist of any kind, or anything in between, the truth is that no matter how you define yourself, feeding your creative hungers makes you feel more alive. And it's how you change the world. I am Melissa Dinwiddie, passion pluralite artist, happiness catalyst, and creativity instigator, here to address all your questions about living a full color creative life. And today on the podcast, I have an interview with Jeff Goines, writer, blogger, author of The Art of Work, a wonderful book, which is not, as you might think, about work so much as it is about callings and how to find yours. Jeff sat down with me a couple of different times to have conversations over Skype, and the first time we spoke, my computer crashed about 15 minutes into our conversation and completely lost the recording. So he graciously agreed to do a do-over of those first few questions that I asked. So if you notice an odd transition in the middle of this episode, that is why. I started our conversation by asking not about writing, but about Jeff's year as a touring musician.
Live creative now.
What was it like traveling with the band?
It was more boring than exciting. It was great. It was fun. But I thought, well, this will be great. I'll be playing music all the time. You don't play music all the time when you're touring and you don't have road managers or, roadies. Groupies too. When you don't have anybody but, you know, you and the, you know, six other people that drive around the country, all over North America we went in a conversion van with a trailer with all your stuff. So you're unloading and doing all that stuff. But, you know, basically it's 12 hours of waiting for 1 hour of performing every day.
Yeah.
And it's not bad. It's just – like you realize, oh, like I'm spending most of my time watching DVDs, you know, watching old episodes of Friends or something, or talking or playing games or just hanging out with these people. And the I think the beautiful part about that was me learning how to be present to this, you know, family, really. It became a family. We toured for a year and realizing it was about the music sort of, but the music was basically an excuse for us to do life together. And that was the big thing that came out of that experience, was learning how to live in community. It was sort of like a preparation for marriage in a lot of ways, because, you know, you live together, you get annoyed with each other, you think it's going to be great, and there's all these things that you didn't expect to happen. So it was good, but it wasn't the good that I was expecting. It was something very, very different.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from other people who've done a lot of touring, and as somebody who's done a lot of touring as a teacher, yeah, same experience, like, you know, 18 yeah, hours of traveling for 1 hour of teaching or something.
Yeah. And that 1 hour can be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there is this sort of weird like build up, and then there's this high, and then there's like, well, what do I do now? Well, I guess I go home, you know? And that's what speaking is like for me now. And that high is really great. And then it's like, and now you're in an airport. And you're delayed for 3 days,
you know, right?
And you're gonna eat, some old Chinese food or something. So it's not bad. It's just be prepared for what you think you're getting into. But being on the road was very different. I realized that we spent most of our time waiting for the next thing to happen. I mean, it impacted me so much. I wrote a book about this called The In Between, and I realized, man, like I can spend 12 hours waiting for this 1 hour, or I can realize that I can be doing a lot during these 12 hours and I can be fully present to these 12 hours, not falling asleep in the back of a van, but, you know, being present to these people around me and the experiences that we're having together.
That's a pretty cool lesson.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you write on somewhere on your webpage that I was stalking you on, you write, "I believe we all have a creative gift worth sharing with the world." And I cannot agree more. It's a huge part of my mission is to get people to really uncover their own creative gifts and share them.
Yeah.
And so much of the problem I see with so many people that I talk to is that people don't, we don't see our gifts, right? And most people that I meet don't even think of themselves as creative. So what I'm curious about, as somebody who really lives a creative life, have you always known that you have a creative gift? Was there a moment when you felt like, bing, wow, yes, I have a creative gift?
Yeah, so did I always know I had a creative gift? I think a gift is a really hard thing to know that you have if you've had it your whole life. Because if it's a gift, by definition, you didn't really earn it. It was just given to you. And I do, I mean, I kind of believe in both the mysterious and practical sides of creativity. I think there are things that I create. I go, where did that come from? I don't know. I mean, there is a spirituality to it that I'm somewhat comfortable with. And then there's a very practical part of like, that magic doesn't seem to happen unless I put my butt in the chair. So you know, it is this really interesting paradox. But no, I grew up thinking that the things that were normal and obvious and even sometimes easy to me were normal and obvious to other people. And it wasn't until my late 20s when I started really being honest about what I wanted out of life, what I didn't want, what looked like success or failure, that I started to recognize there are things that make me a certain way that aren't true for everybody. And I love the way Parker Palmer talks about this. He calls it listening to your life. And he says, before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, I need to listen to my life telling me who I am. So at 27 years old, I'm kind of having this, you know, crisis where I'm anticipating that, you know, in 10, 15 years, I'm going to be having a midlife crisis if I'm doing the same thing. I didn't hate my job, actually liked it, didn't necessarily love it. It was good, but not great. It started out being something really challenging and engaging, and it became something that wasn't as challenging and at times was a little bit boring. And so I was just looking for that next thing. But I wanted that next thing to be an investment that got me, you know, to middle age where I realized this is good. Like I invested 10 years of my life into what will hopefully be my calling, you know? And so I started listening to my life, which just meant that I started paying attention to what are the things that have always been true about me? And what's always been true about me is I've always liked making things. I liked drawing Garfield cartoons when I was in elementary school, and I won the school spelling bee when I was in middle school. And in high school, I started playing the guitar, and I was in this band called Decaf. We called ourselves Decaf because we didn't have a drummer, and we thought, like, decaffeinated music would be like without percussion. You know, it just wouldn't have the kick to it that you would have with a drummer. And you know, and then in college, I continued with music. I really thought once I started playing music that it was the thing, so much that when I graduated, I joined a band. And then halfway through that year, I realized I don't love this like I thought I would love it. Some of it was the travel, but a lot of it was like I could take or leave this. And I realized that I was spending all of my day looking forward to the night when we would stay with host families. We would stay in other people's houses. We didn't even have enough money to get hotels, and so we lined up all, like, people would just let us, you know, sleep on their couches or whatever. And so we didn't have I didn't have a computer. There was our sound engineer had a laptop. And he would always take that home with him. And so unless he and I were staying in the same place, I didn't have access to a computer. So I'd always look forward to going into somebody's house and, you know, using their computer with their permission. And I would write a blog post basically talking about what we did that day or that week. And that was like the highlight of my week, was being able to do that. So I'm listening to my life and I'm paying attention to things that have always been true. When I think about that, I think about, well, in college, I studied Spanish and I studied religion. I had this double major in these very practical degrees. I guess Spanish is kind of practical. Religion really wasn't. But I studied these things because I was interested in them. And I realized when I got really stressed during finals time, I would escape to the computer lab and I would write. I would just write stories or essays, and I would email them to myself because Dropbox didn't exist then. And I realized that for most of my life, creativity was an escape. I think Elizabeth Gilbert talks about this in one of her TED Talks, where she says, home is the place where you feel most like yourself. It is not a place. It is often a community or a thing that you do that makes you feel like you. And for me, writing was my home. You know, expressing myself creatively was the thing that I felt most comfortable doing. And much like anything that you grow up with, you know, again, going back to the marriage analogy, when you marry somebody, you think that your normal is their normal. and if you're healthy, I think you realize that you're both a little bit abnormal, and that's okay too. But I thought, like, that's normal. Like, everybody has their mom read them the dictionary on long road trips when they're 7 years old. And when the winning word of the sixth grade spelling bee for me was acquiescence, I just thought that was normal for a 12-year-old. And, you know, when you listen to your life and you start to pay attention to the themes and you kind of learn about what, you know, other people's normal looks like, you realize that there's some things that make you weird and that there's something telling about that weirdness that I think can help you understand what is your calling, what is the thing that you're meant to do. And so at 27 years old, I realized maybe I'm supposed to be a writer, and that's what really began this whole journey.
Wow. I love that so much, like listening to your weird. Because, you know, the idea, the question of, all right, what makes you different? What's unique about you? And what's your special gift and all of that? It can feel so huge and overwhelming and, you know, so fraught. And like, listen to your weird just seems a little easier to, for me to tap into.
Yeah. And there's a market advantage to that as well. I mean, it's fun and fulfilling, but if somebody's listening to this going, yeah, but like, who cares if I'm weird? Like, I need to make a living or whatever, or be successful. I was talking to somebody just before I came over here, and I said, you know, I've got this friend who is a musician. I live in Nashville. There's a lot of musicians here. And I was talking to this woman whose husband is a musician. She's like, how do you make it? How do you monetize your passion? I said, well, I don't know that you do. I don't know that you do monetize your passion. I could sit in, you know, my basement and say, I love toy airplanes, waiting for somebody to come along and pay me for that passion. And that might never happen. And it seems to me that the people that get paid to do what they love are people who look for, you know, opportunities to do that. But so I have this friend who is a musician, and I told this person this story. I go, look, I have a friend who went from being a starving artist where everybody knew his name to becoming a multimillionaire and nobody knows his name. And he's been doing like playing music like through and through. One was he was trying to get on the radio, trying to get on the next stage and exhausting all of his resources to be famous because he thought that was going to make him successful. And then he crashed and burned. And then he was like, well, I got to figure this out. And I just got to take care of myself and my family. And his record label dropped him and his manager dropped him. And he was on the street trying to figure this out. And he starts figuring some things out. And people always ask me, what are the things that he figured out? And I go, well, that's up to him to tell. But I asked him this one time. I go, why do so many people struggle and you don't anymore? He said, because I'm doing something different. I took the things that I felt like were weaknesses to me. I wasn't a big name anymore. I wasn't on the radio. I wasn't getting booked. And I found ways to leverage those. Everybody else is competing for the same thing. They're all trying to be famous. He goes, I did that. I failed at it. I was famous. Everybody dropped me because my record stopped selling. So I had to figure out another way. And so what if the things that made you weird, that made you different from everybody else, could be turned into advantages if you just recognize them? And so for my friend, it made him a millionaire. And I think there's something powerful about that. Don't try to do what everybody else is doing. Look at the things that make you unique that maybe even feel like disadvantages and ask yourself, how could I be really great at this? And what might that mean for me? And how could that set me apart from what everybody else is trying to do? It's something that I still have to remind myself to do. Like, okay, like you're weird and different. And these could actually be advantages if you know how to use them the right way.
You tell that story about your friend in your book, don't you?
Yeah.
And what?
The millionaire musician.
Yeah. So what? How does he make his money?
He makes his money playing shows. You know, but it's all about. It's not trying to get on the big stage. You know, in music, I guess people don't realize this. Musicians opening acts for big bands. Some of them pay to be there. On that tour because they get exposure. And you can spend your whole life paying to get exposure and never really making it because we think fame equals success. So how does he make money? it's complicated. Like, you know, anybody who is, you know, self-employed trying to make it work, but it works. And I asked him, I said, like, what changed for you? I remember having a dinner with him. I just met him. I said, I remember you from long ago. What have you been up to? He goes, well, like, when we got to know each other, I realized he was very, very successful. But from my perspective, he wasn't famous anymore, so he must have been struggling. And I said, what changed for you? He said, everything changed for me when I stopped trying to be famous and started trying to succeed. And he's very clear to say, like, look, success doesn't equal money, but it's just, what do you actually want to accomplish? Because I think a lot of us are trying to become famous or well-known or have a big brand or whatever because we think that's going to get us something. And I know lots of famous people who are broke, miserable. Fame is not always what it's cracked up to be. It's not necessarily bad, but if you're using fame or money or whatever you think the goal is to actually get you something else, it may not happen. It may not be the means to the end that you think it is. And so I think the lesson is to be careful what you optimize for. But he's doing the same thing he's always done. He's playing shows. He's just doing it in a way where he, you know, in music, you've got booking managers, you've got your record label. You literally have like sometimes a dozen different hands in the pot. So you could be generating lots of revenue for the overall machine and be getting a fraction of it. Book publishing is the same way. So if you want to take on more risk or figure out different things to do, you know, you can reap the rewards.
Yeah. I've been playing house concerts, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's an audience who really wants to be there as opposed to playing at a restaurant or a bar or something where I'm just wallpaper.
Yep.
They're there to listen.
Yeah, engaged.
They're super engaged and all the money goes directly to me. So it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, cutting out the middlemen. I mean, you know, Johnny Cash or Elvis or, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it was a whole different world. And those middlemen, you needed them. Yeah. And they brought real value to the table. But the reality is, I mean, we have incredible resources and tools at our disposal with the internet and the technology available to many of us that in some ways it makes the use of those middlemen not necessary.
Yeah.
And I'm not just, I mean, I have friends who do that. Their jobs are to be middlemen for big, big acts. So there's still a place for that. It's not essential like it was before. There are ways to figure it out if you're a writer of a publisher or a record label or some, you know, art dealer hasn't come and picked you and said, like, I want to help you, you can still do it. Like, it doesn't mean, you know, you're a failure. 50, 100 years ago, it meant you were done. Your career was over. No, if they're not going to pick you, then you're not going to make it. And that's just not true anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to get back to creativity and writing. You write on your About page that you have been writing most of your life, but only recently did you become a writer. And I want to unpack that a little bit. I talk with people all the time who do some kind of creative pursuit, but they're really hesitant to claim the label, you know? Yeah. I make art, but I'm not an artist. Or I sing, but I'm not a singer, et cetera, et cetera. And I know you've written a book called You Are a Writer, So Start Acting Like One. Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious about your relationship with the word writer and why, if you've been writing most of your life, why you say that you only recently became a writer.
So there's basically two definitions of writer. There's like the capital W writer, one who writes for a living, and there's a certain amount of prestige that comes along with it, or pity, depending on who you ask. And then there's the, you know, just regular writers, you know, somebody who writes and you know, like one who writes a lowercase cap, you know, lowercase W. And I remember writing, blogging, always this sort of the side gig, this thing that I did as a form of expression. And I would never call myself a writer because I had attached a certain persona to that, somebody who was famous, who was well known, but I actually didn't really have an adequate description for it. I just knew that I wasn't it. And so I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine when I was really, you know, going back to this 27, 28-year-old me, trying to figure out what am I supposed to do if what I'm doing, you know, for my career is not what I feel like I ultimately want to be doing. What is that thing? And how do I start taking steps towards that? Because I'm still young enough to make that pivot, but I'm old enough to know, like, I don't want to be having this conversation with myself every 10 years and never do anything about it. You know, I really want to give it a try. And so I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and he said, "What's your dream?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Really? Because I would have thought that your dream was to be a writer. You know, just knowing you, reading your blog, like that seems to me what you really want to do." And I said, I guess I'd like to be a writer someday. And he just looked at me and he said, "Jeff, you are a writer. You just need to write." And I was doing some writing on the side, but I hadn't really been taking it seriously. And so I tell this story a lot. I recently told this, and this friend, his name's Paul, watched the video, and he didn't realize the impact of that conversation, because the next day I got up at 5 a.m. and I started writing.
Wow.
And I did that every day for the next year. And what I realized is that activity follows identity. That before you can do something, I think you have to become someone. You have to believe that this is true about you, and that the best activity flows from a sense of strong identity. That I'm a writer, therefore what do writers do? They write. This to me isn't the same thing as faking it till you make it. If that construct helps you, you know, feel free to use it. But I think it's really about believing something until you become it. And so for me, it was a question of, look, like, I'm not a best-selling author. I'm not all these things that I thought sort of went along with this idea of being a writer, but I do write. And it's not like being a doctor. It's not like saying, "Oh, I'm just going to call myself a doctor." No, you got to have degrees, and you got to do this, and you got to do that. But to be a writer, what do you need? I think I can call myself a writer now. I've published 4 books, you know, hit bestsellers list, made enough money to make a living. I think I can do that. And still, there's a part of me that goes, I don't know. And what I can tell you, as far as I can tell, like, my job is to get up and try to write something every day. And there are days where I should fire myself for not doing that job very well. So I think that, yeah, if you're going to enter into the life of an artist, you have to have a very real, serious conversation with yourself about, who am I really, and how does that affect what I'm going to do? Because I think you will not do your best work if you're constantly doubting yourself, saying, "I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'll be that thing someday." I think if you think like an amateur, you'll do the work of an amateur. If you think like a pro, you'll do the work of a pro eventually. Because what kind of practice does a professional do versus, "Oh, I just kind of do this on the side," you know? Very, very different.
Yeah, it's so true. It's really so much about approach rather than what you're producing necessarily.
Yeah, like the process versus result.
Yeah.
Think about it like in athletics, which is not my strong suit. But, you know, what's the difference between a guy who or gal who thinks of themselves as, you know, "I'm a professional weightlifter," or "I want to be a professional weightlifter"? When they go into the gym, what does their practice regimen look like compared or contrasted with, you know, somebody like me who occasionally goes into the gym and goes, "I just don't want to die before 60. like that's my goal, is to not have a heart attack, you know, next Thanksgiving. So what do I need to do to just kind of maintain the status quo bare, you know, like, it's just a different mindset. Like, exercise is something that I do, you know, as not as a hobby necessarily, but just as like an add-on to the rest of my life. Well, the person who wants to be on, you know, the next American Ninja Warrior, whole different kind of mindset. And I think before you get that result, you have to approach it with a certain mindset and have that mindset influence the process. The problem is we think, well, I'm not that thing, therefore I'm not going to try that hard. Or you keep trying and you get to that result and you don't even recognize it. And you just go, "Oh, I'm not a writer yet. I'm not an artist yet. I'm not a musician yet." And I have sort of a blue collar approach to that. If you do the work every day, you are the thing. So own it and do better work.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting thing, because I've experienced that in my own life as well, that it takes a real mindset shift to take the work or whatever it is that you need to be doing seriously enough to do it, so that you identify with the thing. And, you know, like, how do you think a person gets to that mindset shift?
I think that's an act of faith. I think you don't feel it, you do it, and then you start to believe it. You know, for me, the process is basically say it, you know, then do it, then believe it. For me, the belief kind of happens at the end, which is funny because, I mean, faith is sort of on both sides of it, because you're basically saying it, like not really believing it, believing that it might, but like hoping that it might could be possibly true, but you're not going, yeah, like I know this is true. And for me, I started calling myself a writer, which forced me to start doing the work, like really doing the work, not doing it on an occasional Saturday when I kind of felt like it, doing it every single day like a professional would do with the time that I had, which was sometimes just 30 to 60 minutes in the morning. And then I did that enough that this confidence came with it, that today I can go, yeah, I'm a writer. I've done some things that people would go, yeah, he's not an amateur. But in the beginning, I think there's all this self-doubt and people are doubting you, and that's okay. You have to own it first before other people are going to believe that thing about you. And for me, this is probably the most controversial thing that I say, and people get mad about it a lot, this idea that if you want to be a writer, start calling yourself a writer. If you want to be an artist, start calling yourself an artist. I go, no, you got to do all these things. And fine, that's not my belief. My belief is, knowing lots of writers and creatives and artists, the biggest thing they struggle with is confidence. I think that affects their work. And I think there's something to be said. Like, if you go around calling yourself a writer, an artist, and you don't do the work, then you're a liar. Okay? You're not a writer, an artist. You're a liar. But I think there's something to be said about putting yourself out there, like at a party or whatever. I have lots of friends who became writers when they just started calling themselves writers. And there was this expectation that came with it. When you start calling yourself that, people go, oh, what have you written? I gotta go do something.
See you later.
Like for me, it made me do it, because I didn't, because I was gonna keep saying that, and it was gonna be a very uncomfortable social situation. I go, well, nothing really, you know. It made me do something. And initially it was, well, I write a blog. Oh, really? What's your blog? And it wasn't much. But those kinds of conversations, I think, force you to do the work. And you can live off an idea of doing something. But eventually I think you get found out. And I think putting yourself out there, putting your butt on the line, I think forces you to be a little bit more diligent with the time that people don't see you in public. And yes, it does open the possibility that you could just be a total fake, and that would be unfortunate. But I know so many true artists who refuse to own the title, and mm-hmm. I see their work suffer as a result. And I would rather risk saying everybody could be a writer. Everybody can be an artist. It just begins with you believing that first about yourself, acting like it, and then, you know, the confidence comes with that action.
Yeah. Having gotten burned out from creating art, thinking, oh yeah, I'm creating art, I'm fine, I'm feeding my creative spirit, when in fact I wasn't. I'm really curious about other people's relationship to their creative expression. So in your case, like, what is your relationship to your writing? Does your writing, I know your writing is a big income source for you, does it also feed your creative spirit? Have you had to figure out a way to feed your creative spirit that's separate from the writing that you do, that feeds your belly?
I like that you talked about buckets, because it's interesting. I sort of felt guilty for a long time that that I approached what I did. I don't make most of my money off of writing. I make some money off of writing. And initially, I made a bunch of money off of writing. And that opened up all kinds of other opportunities to make a living. Most writers that I know who are making it, there are some exceptions, but most writers, if they're working writers, if they're full-time writers, they're not making their money off of their writing. They've got other ancillary income sources. Nonfiction writers tend to do a lot of speaking. Fiction writers can make a living if they write a ton of stuff and self-publish it, or they get a really big book contract. But most people I know who are working, artists, creatives, they've got some form of an income source, whether that's a day job or a consulting business, or, you know, they do some freelance work. And then they've got, you know, as you described it, sort of the art or passion bucket. I always felt guilty about that. I thought I should be just like my business should be my passion, should be, you know, like what I do should make all the best money in the world. And the more I study the stories of famous authors, artists, and creatives, I realize that's just practically never been the case. I mean, it's sort of the exception to the rule. The rule is, if you create a masterpiece, often it's not the thing that you'll be famous or successful for in your lifetime. You know, like F. Scott Fitzgerald was a writer who made money off of his writing, but he never made great money in his lifetime off of Great Gatsby. That came, you know, many years after. And he died feeling like a failure because he'd made a bunch of money, kind of peaked at the beginning of his career. Then, you know, he loved a party and, you know, and his wife went crazy and he had to, you know, pay doctor's bills and whatnot. And so he went to Hollywood to make it as a screenwriter, you know, which in retrospect, I mean, who knows, but, you know, probably wasn't the best move. It certainly didn't create, I mean, it didn't do much for him creatively. It didn't really lead to any enduring work that I know of. But, you know, so that's sort of the classic example, you know, where you've got writers or artists like Van Gogh who are struggling and yet they've got to figure out, or somebody for them has to figure out, how are you going to make a living? And I'm a very practical guy, and it sounds like you are too, Melissa. You know, I think that people love to talk about how Van Gogh never sold a painting. All my creative friends want to talk about that and hold that up as the example. Nobody wants to talk about how his brother Theo bankrolled him for 10 years. The reality is a starving artist starves, that you don't make art if you aren't making a living doing something, because paint costs money, canvases cost money, computers cost money. You don't have to be making $1 million and you don't have to be, you know, and you also don't have to be a commercial artist, but you got to figure out a way to pay for all this. And so I was working a day job and I was writing for an hour or two at night. And there was something about that dichotomy that I found healthy, where I'm doing something to pay the bills and then I'm doing something to feed my creative soul. But I also didn't like the restraints of having a day job. And I thought, what if I just sort of transfer this balance of work and art, and I am both the source of the work and the art, where I have a business that generates income that gives me flexibility to you know, create more art, things that don't necessarily have to pay the bills. And so I look at the things that I do. First of all, I want to go on record saying I love everything that I do because I'm in control of it. So I like the work a lot more because I'm in control of it. There's nothing that I do that I particularly hate. There are some things that are sort of a drag, like, you know, like bookkeeping, and I try to outsource that. And then there's some things that are way more fun, but it's all kind of on a you know, a spectrum of love. Like I love all this stuff, but some stuff I really, really love. I tend to love and enjoy and feel fulfilled by the things that I can create that I'm not forced to sell. Cause I think every creative person would say there's something really pure about that. And sure, once in a while you do that and people want to pay you a bunch of money for it, but that, you know, that's sort of a hard business model. It doesn't always work that way. So yeah, the stuff that I make money off of is really, you know, doing online teaching, selling online courses. I basically run an online business helping writers and creatives learn about marketing, learn about business, figure out how to make it, but particularly for the content creators. And my books, even my blog, all that stuff for me is art. And I get paid for it. Like I get paid to write a book, but not really. I mean, somebody pays you $50,000 to write a book, and you get that $50,000 over the course of 2.5 years, because you get it when you sign the book contract, you get it when you turn the manuscript in, and then you get it when the book actually publishes, and then maybe you'll make royalties after that if you sell enough copies of the book. You know, like you're pulling in like $25,000 a year to, you know, do this thing that costs you thousands of hours. I mean, you can get a better job. So to say I make money off of writing books is, you know, quite an overstatement. I do it because I love it and because there are some, you know, there's some business strategy behind it, where if my books get out there, people read it, they go, I want to go find out more about this guy and, you know, check out some of the other things that he's doing. But really, I see it sort of as a form of self-patronage. You know, back in the Renaissance or even in the, you know, some late Middle Ages, you know, you had rich people paying artists to create things. But that wasn't the golden age that all my artistic friends think it is, where they go, oh, I could just get paid to create whatever I wanted.
No.
You got paid to create whatever the Pope wanted you to create, or king, you know, the King of France wanted you to create, or the Medicis wanted you to create. You were – wherever the money is, that's where the control is. And for me, as a creative person, I'm trying to control the money. And the best way that I know how to do that is to have a business that generates income that allows me other creative outlets. And at times, as you mentioned – those kind of live in the same arena, you know, where I get to do creative stuff and get to make really good money doing it. And there's other times where I get to do really creative stuff and make a little bit of money or no money at all. And then there's stuff that I do that, again, I enjoy doing because there's a lot of control and freedom over it, and it makes a good amount of money. But the reason I do that is because it provides opportunities to create more art.
I love it. This is such an important area to talk about because so many people are so misinformed about it and really have this idea that, oh, if I could only be a full-time artist or a full-time writer, then I could spend 8 hours a day doing my creative thing. And that isn't reality. And also, not doing your creative thing as your full-time gig is not a bad thing. It's not anything to be ashamed of. I was just talking with a 23-year-old musician who was feeling so deflated and bummed out that she'd decided not to pursue the, you know, being a labeled musician and touring and all of that, because she saw that that wasn't the life that she wanted. And then she was feeling guilty that, like, oh, maybe that makes me not a real musician because I'm not doing the full-time music thing. And she's found another way to bring in money, but that money is a resource that enables her to do her music the way she wants to do her music. So this is a model that so many of our top creatives throughout history, well, maybe not during the Renaissance, but more recently have managed to do their work. You know, they're a banker and then, you know, they wake up at 5 and write for 3 hours before they go into the office or something like that.
Yeah. T.S. Eliot was a banker.
Right.
And Hemingway was a journalist. I think the thing that people have to remember is you can't take money off the table. You either have to make money with a day job, meet some rich dude, good luck with that, you know, or generate it yourself through, again, you can also, you know, use your creativity, use that creative brain to creatively find a way to make money. Fitzgerald, going back to him, that was an example where he would write for the popular magazines and journals, and then he would write a great story. And then he would make it a bad story, meaning a commercial story that he could actually sell to the popular, you know, press. And he would use the money that he got from that to go write his next novel. And Hemingway wrote about that in A Movable Feast. And he didn't like that. He criticized Fitzgerald for doing that. But it's a model. There's lots of different models. I mean, Hemingway was just – he was doing – until his books really started selling, he was being a journalist. And he was actually a journalist his whole life, which is interesting. So – he kind of did this bivocational thing. I think the thing that we don't pay enough attention to is how your day job or how your side gig can make your art better.
Yeah.
And this idea that you're going to go create for 8 hours a day is just ludicrous. No professional full-time writer, artist, whatever that I know does that because that's actually not always the most creative thing to do. Writers tend to write in bouts of, I mean, really dedicated – super disciplined writers that I know write for no more than 5 or 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
Most write for like 2 to 3, and it's a deep dive, and they just pound it out, and then they're done for the day. And then if you're a musician, you know, there are those times when you're going to be in the studio for like a solid week straight, and then not so much, you know, or like when you're touring and you're going to be sitting in the car picking your nose, you know, watching through all of, you know, all seasons of Smallville as we did years ago. And then you're going to like be on stage for like an hour. You know, this idea that like you're going to translate an 8 hour desk job scenario to your art is silly because it doesn't work that way. I remember when I quit my job, I was like, I'll have all the time in the world to write. It'll be amazing. And I didn't create anything for like 3 months because I had so much time. I didn't know how to be productive. Sometimes often the constraint makes you more creative.
Oh my gosh, definitely. I think constraint is one of the huge keys to unlocking, turning on those creative tabs. Which brings me to a question. Do you have a routine or something that gets you creating regularly? You're very prolific. You write frequently on your blog and for other blogs, and you also have a podcast, and you write books, and you create content for your courses. What is your, as if there's a typical day, but what does your typical day look like in order to support that prolific creating?
I appreciate the question with the caveat. There is no typical day. I don't know how to answer this question. The only routine I have is I get up every day and feed my son breakfast. Like, that's the only routine. We hang out. My wife gets to sleep in because she's got the hardest job in the world. And then she gets up and takes over, and I try to head off to the office. I have an office outside of her home, which is a total blessing and a good thing. And it took me years to get comfortable with that. But when I finally did, I like it. I like going away to work. I like leaving work at work. For me, work and life sort of like bleed together on the canvas together. And I think that's good, but you know, like it gets dangerous when I'm checking my phone, when I'm going, you know, going to the park with my son. That's not good. So my only routine really is I have to write every day. And that's just some sort of weird feeling in myself that if I don't finish the day without having written something just to write, something that isn't going to, you know, get me paid immediately, something that isn't, you know, maybe it's on deadline, but I have to write something, not an email, not a tweet. These things don't count. Like, I have to write something. I have to pull something out of the well and, you know, put it on the computer and then save it and come back to it later. And one of the things that I do is the way that I write, I tend to write in three buckets, I call them, where I capture ideas throughout the day. That allows me to not always be in creative mode, but at the same time capture something if it comes to me without trying to remember it or come back to it later. Then actually drafting something and then editing something. And I do those three activities every day. I tend to do the writing in the morning, but not always. And then the afternoons are, because I run a business, you know, I'm talking to people every day. I've got a team. I work with people. I have coffee with friends. You know, I think the main routine is getting up, spending time with my family, because I think I have to remember, I have to discipline myself to remember that this is, if I lose this, I've lost everything. I've done that. You know, I've walked that line, and it's not fun. I like what Stephen King says is that he said in his book on writing, he said that I used to think that life was a support system for art, but now I realize it's the other way around. And so my art, my the work that I do is very important, but it is a support system for the life that I want to live. You know, in other words, my wife's job isn't to just make me successful, and to, you know, and my son's job isn't to leave me alone so that I can sell more books and be more creative. That's not the way it works at all. And then to write. And then, you know, I usually have lunch with somebody every day. I like spending time with people, 'cause when you work for yourself, like, it's not fun, you know? And if you're, it's not fun to just stare at a wall all day. There are days when you got to go into the cave and make something, but, forcing yourself to be social when you're doing this full time, I think is really important. And I missed that for a long time. And then, yeah, the afternoons are email, phone calls, correspondence. And really, if I do anything, I batch stuff. You know, today's an interview day. Tomorrow's a, you know, writing day. I write usually in the morning. All mornings are blocked off to write. But then if I'm working on a book, I'll have deep dives of research or something like that. But it's like most people's days. It's kind of all over the place, and I feel like I'm trying to catch up on things. But again, I can't end the day well, feeling good about myself, if I haven't written something.
Yeah, I'm very similar. If I don't achieve something during my day, I go to bed feeling so bummed out.
Yeah, and you know, if I've answered a bunch of emails and managed a bunch of people and done some business deals, and I haven't worked on the craft, I feel like a fake.
As a passion pluralite with a lot of different creative pursuits, I notice myself feeling like a fake if I introduce myself as an artist and I've been focusing on music for the past few weeks or months, uh-huh, and I haven't been painting regularly, then I'm just like, how can I introduce myself as an artist, you know? But I'm curious, do you identify as an introvert or an extrovert?
Yeah, it's a good question. I usually show up as an X on those.
I would have guessed, because I work at home all the time, and you know, I lead a lot of online classes, but you know, I can spend days where I realize I haven't left the house. Yeah. Maybe I've gone to a yoga class, you know, and I'm fine with that.
Right. I think I'm probably a shy extrovert, and there is such a thing, you know, you get energy from being around people, but you don't need to like go up and talk to those people. If I'm not around people, I feel like I'm missing out on something. But then, you know, but I can't be around people all the time, you know. So I get worn out at parties. So I'm like right on
kind
the
of
line.
On the cusp,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do like being around people. I do like people, and I get lonely. I get lonely in the work, and like to be around other people.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your book. You write, "Your calling is a gift, one that is intended to be given away." And I just love that statement. And this is really a tricky thing for a lot of creators to embrace. Mm-hmm. For those who are, you know, called to some sort of creative expression, mm-hmm. first they have to get past the fear and the self-doubt in order to create, right? That's mm-hmm. the first big hurdle.
Yeah.
And then they have to get past all the gremlins that tell them that their work isn't good enough to share and all the fear of criticism and all of that. And I've done a lot of thinking about this because this is something that I've struggled with a lot in my own life. And I, you know, I teach this stuff and I wonder how much of it is the difference between the desire to impress somebody and wanting to share. So impress versus sharing. I know for myself as a music artist and performer, I had to get past the need to impress people with my singing or my playing or my songwriting or whatever, and reset my mindset to, I want to share. I want to share a song with you. And that has made such an enormous difference. And I'm curious whether you have had your own battles, and if you could talk about your own battles getting past those fear and self-doubt gremlins.
Sure. Yeah. So on the gift thing, Lewis Hyde writes a great book called The Gift, which is, I think, essential reading for any artist. And he, you know, very succinctly says that art is a gift. And he means that with sort of the double meaning, meaning a lot of people refer to a skill or a talent like, you're so gifted. And it is a gift. I mean, there are times I think almost any honest artist, that's like a great blog name or something. Any honest artist has to admit that there are moments when inspiration strikes you. And usually it's when you're hard at work. But there, most creative people I know who create really amazing stuff say, man, I don't know where that came from. And there's something really beautiful about that, that it feels like a gift, like a supernatural, spiritual, or just, you know, like you didn't know that was in you kind of thing. And then, of course, the other part of the gift is I got to give it away. I have to share it. And I think, you know, this is sort of this timeless art for art's sake, you know, debate. But I believe that art is not art, or at least not, it doesn't fulfill its high, doesn't fulfill its potential until it's actually reached someone. That I think art is the interaction that the creation has with the audience. And it doesn't have to be a million someone, just somebody else. And so if you are a creative person, you know, you're an artist, you make things and share them, whether it's music, words, you know, or, you know, something visual. And that demands to be shared. And I think you feel that angst when it isn't shared. Mm-hmm. Like I was talking to a guy this today for lunch, and he said, he goes, I wrote this novel and I want to make money off of it, and I can't hire an editor, so what should I do? I said, who's read it? Who's read it and said, wow? He goes, well, nobody's read it. I said, that's your first job, is to share it with somebody, not to sell it, not to edit it, but to take this thing and see if it resonates with somebody. And if it's good, you make it better, you know? And if one person likes it, you know, share it with somebody else. So to me, there's that fine line between self-promotion and sharing, or between, you said, impressing, and I would say expressing. To express, I have to, like an audience is implied. I have to do it where somebody is acting as a sounding board, whether you're, you know, playing the music and somebody's nodding along, or, you know, writing a book and somebody posts a review or emails you, or you, you know, meet them and they say, thank you, this meant a lot to me. So I think that an artist is given a gift that they have to share with the world, and the gift that they give to the world is, here's my thing, maybe it'll connect with you. And you could say, here's my thing, and people pay for it. I mean, you know, book paper costs money. Canvases cost money. I don't think that as soon as money enters the field that it immediately pollutes or muddies the water. But I think that when you're creating that thing, you're creating it with the intent to share, not make a buck. That's my opinion. But you can share it, you know, and when you share it, I think the gift that the audience gives back to the artist is the gift is not money. The gift is, thank you, that touched me. The gift is, I'm going to tell five friends about this. To me, the gift is, I want to share this experience with other people. Like when I paid, I don't know, $100 or whatever to go to our local symphony and watch our local symphony, the orchestra play throughout Led Zeppelin's catalog. That was awesome.
Wow.
Totally cool. And everybody I could talk to about that, especially about our symphony hall, which completely relies on patronage. You know, like this is not like there are people that fund this. There are people that sponsor it. There are, you know, local businesses supporting this very expensive institution in Nashville. This is not like the same business model as the local movie theater, you know, which is primarily built to entertain. There's something deeper, bigger, I would argue, more transcendent happening there. So the gift that I gave is not my $100 ticket. The gift that I gave is telling everybody, you have to go to this place. It's amazing. They do really cool stuff like, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know, shows, you know, with all their stringed instruments and stuff. It's amazing. That's, I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that an artist is looking for. And for me, that's when I started my blog, all I wanted to do was write stuff and have people read it. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of cool things happen as a result of that. I build a business and I can sell them things. And I happen to think that's okay. Some people could never do that. But for me, it's just a question of, can I create things that create this interaction between myself and the audience? And if they want to share that, if they, you know, if they give me that gift back and say thank you or share it with somebody, like that's a win, like that's success. And my job is just to find ways to pay for me to do more of those things.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, I asked Seth Godin once, who's, you know, a big popular blogger, who blogs every day, sometimes multiple times a day, and sends an email to anybody on his list with each of those blog posts. I said, well, why do you keep blogging every day? Like, isn't that sort of like old hat? And like, do you need to do that? Is that like the smartest marketing strategy or whatever? He goes, oh, I don't do it for that. He goes, I do it because it's the best practice. Like, mm-hmm. I get, like, it's the best practice to write something and share it every single day. And going back to the days of being a musician, I remember the moment when I stopped kind of plucking through chords with my band in our basement, with my friends. It wasn't even a band, with my friends in my basement. And oh, I messed it up. Let's go back. And oh, I messed that up. Let's go back. And then we started booking shows and people started showing up. Tons of people, 5 people, 6 people, sometimes 7 people showed up. And there was this pressure. Yes, it was a pressure to perform, but it was also a pressure to apply the practice and to really keep practicing. It was another form of practice. But this time it was practice in public, which I think is the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And so you share your work, yes, because I think that art that isn't shared doesn't fulfill its potential, but also because it's the best way to practice. So you want it to be really mind-blowingly amazing, then the hardest but best thing that you could do is share your okay work now.
Absolutely.
So that next time it's a little bit better and better and better and better until you know your talent finally lives up to your taste.
So back to your book, The Art of Work, which, you know, if people are looking at that title thinking The Art of Work, is this about, you know, office jobs? This is not what it's about. Really, it's about callings. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you write is your calling is not a job. It is your entire life. Mm-hmm. I really love that. That's something that I've kind of been preaching for a long time. And from my perspective around that, you know, the conversation around creative expression and play, we've talked already about how so many people want to make a living from their creative thing. And, you know, that's really great if you want to do that. But as we've also said, it's not the only way to pursue your calling and live a big, full color, bold, creative, abundant life.
Yeah.
And as I wrote in the margins of my copy of the book right here, a lot of writing in the margins, your whole being makes up your calling.
Yeah.
It's not just what you do for pay or even what you do for a sense of purpose. It's like everything. But mm-hmm. there's so many misunderstandings out there about callings. I think people have this idea that a calling is something that you just discover, like, bam, eureka, mm-hmm. you know, like love at first sight. Mm-hmm. And I have a whole module in my program I used to run called Your Big, Bold Creative Life Academy, mm-hmm. in which I share a lot of realities about callings, a lot of which are really counterintuitive, like wanting to run the other way, huge mm-hmm. resistance is actually a hallmark. of a calling. And I mean, take a look at the stories of Jonah and Moses in the Bible, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason that those are such archetypal characters mm-hmm. running away from their calling. It's because it reflects the human experience.
Yep.
And you share in your book seven signs that you found your calling and the seven stages of a calling. And I would you be willing to talk a little bit more about how you define a calling?
Sure. I was hoping you wouldn't ask me to define those seven things because I was like, oh boy, I don't know. I just threw them in there. I don't know. Yeah, now, talking about the refusal thing is really interesting. Joseph Campbell talks about that and The Hero with a Thousand Faces, monomyth, the idea that there's one story, the best stories are really just one story. And the at the beginning of the journey, there's sort of the call and there's refusal of the call. I mean, look at any hero story. Something bad happens and then everybody wants the hero to do something. And usually he's some like, you know, bad boy. He goes, oh, I'm not going to do that. Or there's some childhood pain or trauma, you know, you can't re-enter that because there's shame or fear or whatever. And man, I was like, that is exactly what happened. People started asking me if I was a writer. My wife started calling me a writer, asked me when I was going to write that book. And I was like, no. And like person after person, after all these different guides came into my life. And finally I was like, okay, all right, okay. So I think a calling is not a perfectly planned life, but in many ways what you do in your life doesn't go according to plan. And yeah, I mean, you talk about biblical characters, they're mythical characters, people throughout history, people who have really done amazing things. Some of them might say, I want to do this ever since I was 2 years old, or I knew I was supposed to be a fireman or a guitarist or whatever. When I started talking to people, when I started reading biographies of those people and honestly talking to real life, everyday, ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things, who had found their calling, most people I talk to say, I don't know what it is, I haven't found it, etc. So to find somebody who says, yep, I'm doing exactly what I was put on earth to do, it's a big deal. Most of them, when I talked to them, said, this was not what I planned. You know, I planned to be a school teacher and now I'm running a business. I planned to be a guitarist and now I'm an author. This was not the thing that they planned. We don't like talking about that though, because this is not the story that we're sold on, you know, VH1 behind the scenes. It's not the story that we tend to clean up, the biographer tends to clean up. But it's amazing to me that when people start out who have really done something amazing that has left a legacy in the world, often when they're getting started, they have no idea, because that's the way great stories are structured. Maybe it's the way the universe is, sort of orchestrated, that there is a pattern, there is a purpose. I believe these things. And so when you start out in life, you want something, you know, that's going to make you look cool or famous or rich or whatever. And the calling is always a call to something deeper and better and more sacrificial and more generous than you looking cool or rich or awesome. And so, yeah, there's going to be this resistance. There's going to be these series of trials that you go through, lots of failure that actually prepares you for the work that, you know, for mastering the work that you're supposed to do. Most books that talk about this, I think, end with mastery, end with becoming awesome at it. Like you say, this is what I want to do, and you go do it. And I find that this is not the way it works, that you don't have a clue. You start learning as you go. You meet somebody who teaches you something. You practice a little bit more. It hurts. It's hard. It's difficult. You fail. And then somewhere throughout the process, you go, oh, like I'm supposed to be a writer. And you're in the middle of doing it, right? And you discover things as you go. I say that clarity comes with action. Everybody wants to get some epiphany and then go do something. And really, the clarity comes with action. You take a step and you go, okay, now I see what the next step to take is. And then you take a wrong step and you have to course correct. But people think that it ends with mastery. I think that there's one step further than mastery, one step further than you becoming the best artist, the best musician, the best whatever the world has ever seen. And that last step is legacy. It's about turning around and teaching others, which is why I love what you're doing, Melissa. It's turning around and it's saying, here's where I'm at in the journey so far, and I want to help others. I want to be that guide to others that I received in some way. And it usually happens with a multitude of mentors. But I want to turn around and I want to pay it forward. I want to give back. I want to help somebody else out. Legacy is not about people remembering my name. It's about helping other people take the next step in their own journey.
I love that so much. Yeah, and you have so many great stories in your book about how people kind of discovered, like, little by little, their calling, yeah. and so many of them, it was some, you know, horrible thing happened in their life or mm-hmm. their family's life, and that led them to this completely different path than anything they ever would have expected.
Yeah.
And that's been definitely my experience.
Yeah. And I mean, good or bad, things are always happening to us that surprise us. You get laid off, your parent, you know, a parent or a spouse or a kid gets cancer. Somebody breaks up with you. You know, sometimes it's, you know, very dramatic. Other times it just feels sort of mundane, but life is always surprising us. Things are not happening according to plan, which should tell us something about our plans. And maybe calling is the thing that emerges in the midst of that very ordinary, very difficult circumstance, which means that because we all face those trials, that all of a sudden calling is not something reserved for the elite, the right. very special people who have a direct line from God or are, you know, tapped into the mojo of the universe. It's something that we can all relate to, we can all access, and we don't have to exactly know what we're supposed to do. Just that we're supposed to take the next step in that journey and learn as we go. But you know, it's helpful to have a guide, which is why I wrote The Art of Work, not just to say, hey, you can do whatever you want, but here's what the path looks like, and here's how to understand where you are in that process and maybe what the next intentional step that you can take is.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I highly recommend that people read the book. It really is like a kind of a – I hesitate to call it a roadmap because – you know, your own direction and path is going to be your own, right? But it really mm-hmm. is like a compass for figuring out what you are supposed to be doing on this planet. And yeah. it's brilliant.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been a delight to talk with you. I have one more question for you before you go. Okay. First, I want to ask you, where can people find you?
You go to my blog, goineswriter.com, goineswriter.com. You can find out more about the book there and sign up for my free email newsletter and get some free tips on how to build an audience and all kinds of other things. And that's goineswriter.com.
Awesome. And then I have one more question for you. You say on your about page that you make the world's best guacamole.
Hands down.
Would you be willing to share your recipe with my audience?
Sure, but it's all in the technique, not in the ingredients. Yeah, if I can remember, really, I use whatever we have in the house. It's not a roadmap. It's just, you know, everybody's path is going to be different. a couple of avocados, aroma, tomato, avocado mash, obviously, tomato diced about as finely as you can. You can leave it chunkier. My wife doesn't like tomato, so I leave a little bit chunkier so she can fish it out. fresh garlic, just really to taste. I mean, I don't know, like a half a clove, maybe less than that. Salt and pepper, lime juice, cilantro. I think that's it. Sometimes I'll sprinkle in a little cumin. I don't do that. Oh, and red onions, diced red onions. Oh,
beautiful.
And sometimes some chia seeds, throw those in there, you know, have lots of fun. You know, get some protein in there. But yeah, those are the basic staples. You can never go wrong with lime juice or cilantro. I mean, I'm a big, big fan of those ingredients.
Awesome. Well, there you have it. The guacamole calling.
Yeah. Yep.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeff. It has been so fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. It was my pleasure.
That's it. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you have been enjoying this podcast, the best way to thank me is to tell your friends and leave a 5-star rating and review over on iTunes. Those ratings and reviews make a really big difference in helping other people find the show, and I would be just tremendously grateful for your review. Thanks again for joining me, and until next time, go get creating. Mwah!
Live creative now. Live creative now.
Subscribe at livecreativenow.com.